From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn, and thanks for joining us during our winter membership drive. Today, my guest for the entire show is musician and bassist Michael Peter Balzari. You probably know him as Flea. As a teenager, Flea met Anthony Kiedis, Hillel Slovak, and Jack Irons at Fairfax High. Together, they formed the Red Hot Chili Peppers in the 1980s, and the rest is history. In addition to his work as the bassist for the Chili Peppers, Flea is also an actor. You might remember his role as Needles in Back to the Future.
What's the matter? Chicken?
Or as one of the nihilists in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah. He believes in nothing.
He has a small part in a new movie written by Lena Waithe and directed by Melina Matsoukas.
It's called Queen and Slim. Incredible script.
But Flea wasn't really here to talk about acting. He was here to talk about his new memoir. It's called Acid for the Children. And it's about his wild days before forming the Chili Peppers.
Are we interviewing right now?
Yeah, we're rolling, man.
Can I take one moment before we start? I have this ritual that I do before I do an interview.
Absolutely.
Sorry. Okay, sorry, call me superstitious, but I do it every time.
That's good.
Okay, yeah.
What's the ritual? Or is
it's
it,
a prayer.
Can you not talk about it? We took a brief pause, and then we launched in. And Flea started with the event that would change the course of his life.
When I was a kid, my father was a very strict man. He, ran the house in a very kind of militant, ship-shaped way. Everything was wholesome. We had dinner every night at 7. He wore a suit, had a briefcase, went to work every day. Very, very normal. And, we came from Australia to America because we were an Australian family. We were in New York for 4 years while he completed his assignment at the Australian consulate. And then we were to return to Australia where we were going to live our Australian lives. And my mom, my wild-ass, heart-following, irresponsible mom, took off with a junky jazz musician who lived in his parents' basement. We left my dad. He went back to Australia without us. And we moved into this life and everything flipped upside down. Everything.
So what is it like to go back there? Because what you're doing in a book is you're excavating the memories about the physical things that happened, but attached to those physical things are emotional feelings about what is happening in and around your life.
Absolutely.
And I think of some stories. I think it's a Halloween story involving your stepfather. Mm-hmm. So when you're recalling these events, how much do you think about your state of mind at that time? Do you have new perspective on how you became the person you are as you're starting to revisit and write down all of these memories?
All of that in spades. It's when I was actually doing the writing, firstly, I would read it to my editor often. I'd write all my stuff and I would read it to him. And while I was reading, invariably, I would start sobbing. And when I did the audio book, it was just like... It was a sob fest, man. It was really emotional. For some reason, I can write it, and it's cool. Like, I just want to write it well and really describe what I'm feeling and try to, do a good job. But when I read it out loud, it's very emotional. That particular event, it was Halloween, and I was out trick-or-treating with some friends. And we ran into all these other kids, these trick-or-treaters, when you're from school, and they're all running home. And they're like, there's a crazy guy in the street. He's shooting a gun. He's berserk. Everyone's scared. Everyone's going home. And I was like, oh, shit, I'm going to get home. And I'm running home, and I get home, and I see, all debris in my front yard. The windows busted out. Like, the TV had flown through the windows in the yard. And I'm like, I didn't register it. And I just ran inside the house, and then I see my stepdad there. And I realize as soon as I walk in, oh, he's the gun-shooting madman. He's the lunatic that everyone's terrified of. And it was sort of this combination of absolute terror of what was he going to do next, because he was sitting there slumped on the couch, like in his underwear, and his blood and guns. And I was also embarrassed because it was my house. People always concentrate, a big part of my child is when I meet Anthony Kiedis, we end up starting at Chili Peppers. And it's a very important relationship in my life. But for me, kind of the emotional center and the thing that I talk about in the book the most is my relationship with Walter, my stepdad, because he was this terrifying man, but he was also, he was a brilliant musician. He was a jazz bass player. He was an absolutely ferocious musician, and he'd play this upright bass, and when he played it, he attacked his instrument with like a violent frenzy, you know, these fast bebop walking bass lines, but he was taking all his torment and turning it into something beautiful through his bass. And even though, like, when I got older and I thought I was rebelling against him by playing rock music, I was doing exactly what he showed me to do.
We're talking with Flea. His new book is called Acid for the Children. I want to play another jazz musician. This song is called A Night in Tunisia. I think you recognize the player?
Yeah, man. The crystal clear sound cutting a hole in the sky, man. That's Dizzy Gillespie.
So tell us about your encounter with Dizzy.
You know, I had started playing the trumpet in seventh grade, and I fell in love with it. And my hero was Dizzy Gillespie. He had this magical trumpet. His cheeks puffed up when he played. He was funny. He dressed wild. He was smart. He was everything that I saw as a great person could be. He was my hero. My mother took me to see him play at Royce Hall at UCLA. I believe it was 1973. I was 12 years old. We're sitting in the audience at Royce Hall waiting for Dizzy to come on. I was like, when's he coming, Mom? When's he coming? She's just, you know, he's coming. Don't worry. And I got to the bathroom, and I jump up to go pee. I run out. I run down the aisle. And instead of going back to the lobby where you're supposed to go to the bathroom, I was just excited and ran towards the stage and just saw a door and ran in it looking for the bathroom. I run in. There's people walking around, and I'm by myself. I'm looking. There's Dizzy Gillespie standing there holding his horn, his magic horn with the bell that pokes up to the heavens. I run up to him in total awe. Mr. Gillespie, Mr. Dizzy, I can't speak. I'm just so in awe that it's him. And he pulls me in and kind of like hugs me with his arm, so my head's up in his armpit and I'm cuddled up next to him. And he just kind of holds me there. And he's holding his horn in one hand. He's holding me in the other hand, embracing me in this like loving embrace, speaking to somebody. And I'm just in heaven, you know. I'm sitting there, and I remember the feeling of him, like the smell of his cologne, his suit, his everything about it. Like, and he was so kind. So sweet, man. And anyway, he keeps talking to this guy for a few minutes, and then he stops talking. The guy kind of looks down, just smiles at me, pats me on the head, walks on stage, starts playing Night in Tunisia. And I'm just, forget all about peeing, you know. So I was just so happy, and it was such a beautiful thing. Yeah, and that's Diz.
Up next on The Frame, more of my conversation with Flea, who talks about growing up in a very different L.A. Welcome back to this Pledge Drive edition of The Frame. I'm John Horn. Before he wore pants made of stuffed animals, before he wore socks in the wrong places, even before he played the bass, Flea was into jazz and books. In his new memoir, Acid for the Children, Flea writes about his childhood years before there were such a thing as the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I'm going to play another piece of music. Okay. This is probably my favorite song by a band that I think you and I both love.
Sometimes I grow so tired, but I know I've got one thing I got to do. I ramble on.
Boom, 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 ba-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
So we've got jazz, we've got Dizzy, and then we've got Led Zeppelin. What point do those different forms of music start to coalesce in your mind as a way to bridge what you've heard your stepdad play on the bass, what Led Zeppelin's doing, and how you can move into rock and roll?
What happens is I meet a boy named Hillel Slovak. And, you know, at this point, I had grown up in such a jazz household. I adopted the jazzer's attitude of a disdain for rock music. I thought it was music for people who just wanted haircuts and silly magazines and clothes. They didn't really care about music. I saw it as like a de-evolution of what music is capable of, which is an arrogant stand for a 13-year-old, 14-year-old boy, whatever, how old I was to take, but that was where I was at. And I meet Hillel, and he's just this beautiful, artistic poet of a kid. You know, he makes these beautiful paintings, he plays guitar, And he's in love with rock music, and he's in love with the whole romancing rock stardom, the whole thing. And we become, I'd already become friends with Anthony. We were very close. We meet Hillel. We become a threesome. And I start falling in love with rock music. I see them play. There's no teachers. There's no one around. Girls come and watch, and they want to see because it's cool. And we're in a room, and they're playing. I watch them play, and I start softening towards it. Music becomes less like a notes and learning complex harmonic ideas than just like this fun, wild, awesome thing, you know? And I start playing. And, you know, shortly after that, Hillel asked me to start playing the bass, and that happens.
We're talking with Flea. His new book is called Acid for the Children. I want to ask you to read something from the book. It's in front of you. It's page 143.
Can I use your reading glasses?
They're not reading glasses.
Are there any reading glasses around?
I don't know.
Because I always
Let's
have
see.
Them, and I was in such a rush to come here that I didn't bring
Let's
them.
Let's see.
Oh!
Oh, my God. Look what Jesus put in your pocket.
The gods want me to read this.
So it starts on page 143. Then there was Freddie Gold.
Then there was Freddie Gold. His two older sisters were both friends with my sister at Hollywood High. Freddie was my first rich friend. When I went over to his house, I discovered an opulence previously unknown to me. A big spread up in the West Hollywood Hills, in the Bird Streets, up above the Sunset Strip, including the famous Blue Jay Way. There's a fog upon L.A., and my friends have lost their way. That's a Beatles song. A big swimming pool, two well-stocked refrigerators, a Salvadorian housekeeper named Bessie in a white suit and hat, everything clean, immaculate white shag rugs, a massive aquarium that bubbled its modern convex way out of the black-tiled wall. Freddie always had weed. We'd smoke it, go in his pool, then the sauna, listening to loud music. The popular stuff, which being a jazz nerd, I knew very little about. Peter Frampton, P-Funk, Led Zeppelin, living it up.
What's interesting about the Freddie Gold story is this idea about class and privilege. You are essentially a latchkey kid. You are on your own, left to your own devices, and you have this friend or these friends who have a different life that you have a glimpse of. How do you think that starts to affect the way you see the world and the way you navigate your way around the things that you don't have?
Yeah, well, one interesting quick aside to that question is that the world was so different then here in the early 70s, because now if a parent has any money, you're going to a private school. But back when I went to the LA public schools, we had every class of kid. That doesn't exist in public school now. I had kids who were poor, whose mothers were streetwalkers. I had kids who, like Freddie Gold, were wealthy. And crazily enough, like, it was I liked, you know, the yummy food. They had a swimming pool. We could go jump in the pool, go in the sauna, do all this fun stuff. He always had weed. But I didn't covet it. I treasured my connection with my other friends, you know, who I had profound relationships with, who had nothing. So it wasn't really about that for me. But it wasn't the nothing that we had was the nothing because we had no peace or harmony in the home. It was our home was a scary home to be in, you know. The things that I wanted to do well at didn't revolve around making money. It was never like, I'm going to make money. I'm going to get this. I'm going to do that. It was more like, I'm going to be a badass on this trumpet. I'm going to wear a suit like Dizzy Gillespie and blow my horn.
We listened to some music by Dizzy Gillespie. We listened to Led Zeppelin. I want to play one more cut. This is a storyteller that I think is important to you.
This is a tale of a meeting of two lonesome, skinny, fairly old white men on a planet which was dying fast. One of them was a science fiction writer named Kilgore Trout. He was a nobody at the time, and he supposed his life was over. He was mistaken. As a consequence of the meeting, he became one of the most beloved and respected human beings in history.
That's Kurt Vonnegut reading Breakfast of Champions.
I've never heard that before.
We can find everything.
Yeah, wow. You know, a lot of my book is me looking for a moral compass and me not having anyone as a parent to guide me as a kid, to like help me transition from a boy to a man, to be there for me, to be present, to be looking at the things I was going through and pay attention. And I found that in my solitude with the books that I loved. I always read. Every day I read. All my life I've read every day, except in my drug days when I was just too damn wasted to like for a word to not be a blurred mess of ants walking around on a page, you know? And I loved Kurt Vonnegut when I was a kid. When I got, I guess it was like I was sixth grade, seventh grade, when I first, I read Breakfast of Champions and, you know, one after other, then, you know, Sirens of Titan, you know, Slaughterhouse-Five, all of them. And he meant so much to me. I just like, because he put the most profound and beautiful statements in the simplest terms. And I really got it when I was a kid. His way of being funny, the way he drew an asshole, little asterisk, which ends up being the Chili Peppers, you know, sign. I just loved him. And he gave me hope that people could be really good. People could do great things, not because they needed to get into heaven or because they wanted something, but because it was the best way to be.
Flea's new book is called Acid for the Children. Flea, thanks so much for coming in.
Okay, and just so you know, I'm not recommending that children take LSD. This is a poetic
this
statement.
This is a cautionary tale in many ways.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
And that is it for The Frame today. Thanks for listening both on the radio and on demand. I'm John Horn, and thanks for supporting KPCC.